Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 3rd of April, these are our main stories. Russian investigators have arrested a 26-year-old woman in connection with a cafe bombing that killed a pro-war blogger in St. Petersburg. The head of NATO says Finland will be formally welcomed into the alliance on Tuesday. The former president of Kosovo, Hashim Thaçi, has pleaded not guilty to war crimes at the start of his trial in The Hague. Also in this podcast...
It has a battery life of 25 minutes. That was not a problem because you couldn't hold this up for 25 minutes. It was so heavy.
We speak to the man who made the first mobile phone call 50 years ago. Russia is calling the bomb blast that killed a top military blogger on Sunday a terrorist attack. Investigators have detained a 26-year-old Russian woman in connection with the explosion, which occurred at a cafe in St. Petersburg, as the blogger, Vladlen Tatarsky, was meeting members of the public. Media reports say he died after a statuette he'd been given by a woman exploded. The spokeswoman for the Russian Investigative Committee, Svetlana Petrenko, confirmed the detained suspect was believed to be that woman.
The Russian Investigative Committee, in cooperation with police, detained Daria Trepova on suspicion of being involved with the explosion in a cafe in St. Petersburg. The necessary investigative procedures are now being carried out with her. We are trying to identify the motive of the crime. Investigators will decide on the form of detention for her.
The authorities also say that Daria Trepova has previously been detained for taking part in protests against the war in Ukraine. Russia's anti-terrorism committee has blamed the bombing on the Ukrainian secret services and supporters of the jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The Russia editor of BBC Monitoring, Vitaly Shevchenko, told us more about the detained woman.
The Russian Interior Ministry has published what seems to be an excerpt from her questioning in which she admits that she had brought the statuette that exploded. But when she's asked about who gave it to her, she says, I'd like to answer that question later. Now, Daria Trepova, she doesn't really have a name or a following. All we know is that she's been taking an interest in politics. Last year, she was arrested at an anti-war rally. And her husband, who is now abroad, he says, he's been telling the media that he doesn't believe that Daria could do anything like this, that she could have willingly and knowingly killed a human being.
The Kremlin is calling this bombing a terrorist act and is blaming Ukraine, accusing Ukraine of being behind this. But in reality, there could be a number of suspects, couldn't there, Vitaly? Not just anti-war activists, but maybe even supporters of the war.
Indeed. Vladlen Tatarsky, the blogger who was killed, he was one of a number of people who are known as war reporters in Russia. And he was at the extreme end of the war reporter scale. And within that group, he was accused by other people like him of being too soft on Ukrainians, even though his views were pretty extreme. So given that he was part of this very volatile crowd, it's easy to imagine that he had some enemies there. But of course, the officials in Moscow, they've been saying it's the Ukraine that did it. And they also have been pointing the finger at followers of Alexei Navalny, the jailed Russian opposition leader as well. Officials in Russia say that they have been involved as well.
And this comes months after the assassination of a high-profile figure, the daughter of a Putin ally, Alexander Dugin. There is speculation there could be a connection there. Could you just tell us, how shocking is this bombing in the cafe? I mean, we hear all the time about violence in Ukraine, but in Russia itself, how much of a shock is this causing?
It's extraordinary. In fact, I can't really remember the last time a cafe exploded in Russia, killing somebody that prominent. But of course, parallels are being drawn with the murder of Daria Dugina. And people who blame Ukraine says they've been saying that this is something that Ukraine is clearly capable of.
Vitaly Shevchenko. Ukraine has meanwhile rejected any suggestion that the bombed-out city of Bakhmut is now in the hands of Russia. The head of the Wagner mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, had made the claim in a video after raising the Russian flag over Bakhmut City Hall.
2 April.
It is the 2nd of April, 11 p.m. local time. The building behind me is the city administration. This is a Russian flag. From a legal point of view, Bakhmut has been taken. It is ours. The enemy is concentrated in the western parts of Bakhmut.
But a spokesman for President Zelensky described this as a funny fake and urged people to remain calm in the face of what he said were invented victories. Russia has been fighting to capture Bakhmut since the middle of last year, with casualties now numbering in the tens of thousands. Our correspondent in Kyiv, Hugo Bishega, told us more about Mr. Prigozhin's video message and Ukraine's reaction to it.
He's saying that the Russian flag is now flying over Bakhmut. And we just had reaction here from the head of the president's office saying that Bakhmut is Ukrainian. Essentially, he is dismissing the claim that Bakhmut is Russian. So it is very, very difficult to independently verify those claims and counterclaims. For a very long time, we've been talking about Bakhmut. Fighting there has been intense. Both Russia and Ukraine have suffered heavy losses. But this city is, you know, victory there is symbolic for both sides. The Ukrainians say that, you know, holding it is key for the defense of larger cities in the east. The Ukrainians are expected to launch a major offensive to try to take back territory that's now under occupation. So they say that it is vital to hold Bakhmut. And for the Russians, capturing Bakhmut would be a rare victory in this war. And I think the leader of the Wagner group wants this victory because this is the group that has been leading the fight there in this battle for this city in the east of the country.
Hugo Bishega. One of the justifications Vladimir Putin has given for his invasion of Ukraine was Kyiv's interest in joining NATO and his claim that the alliance was coming too close to Russia's borders. And yet, Moscow's aggression over the past year has only served to push its neighbours nearer to the West. Now the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, has announced that Finland will be joining the bloc within hours.
This is a historic week. Tomorrow we will welcome Finland as the 31st member of NATO, making Finland safer and our alliance stronger. We will raise the Finnish flag for the first time here at the NATO headquarters. It will be a good day for Finland security, for Nordic security, and for NATO as a whole.
I put it to our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, that Finland would not be joining NATO this week if Russia had not invaded Ukraine.
Finland's always had a strange relationship with first the Soviet Union, then Russia. During the Cold War, Finland really didn't do anything without checking it was okay with Moscow and certainly wouldn't have joined NATO. But the invasion of Ukraine changed all of that. But even since the Cold War, Russia and Finland did have quite good relations, lots of business links and tourist links. Well, that's all over, isn't it? Finland's now firmly in the NATO camp. It's building a huge fence along this 1,300-kilometre border. The business and tourism links have waned away. And yes, NATO's identity now expanded to include Finland, which is bringing, I should say, a pretty large armed forces, well-trained group. Every Finnish person, man, male, does conscription. So they all do military service. It makes a big difference to NATO as well as Finland.
And yet this had been a joint application by Finland and Sweden, but Sweden has not yet made the cut.
No, Turkey is what this is all about. Turkey, or anyone joining NATO, needs to get unanimity from all the other members. Turkey has some problems with Sweden, it says. It says that some of the Kurds welcomed by Sweden are terrorists, and it's also objected to a Swedish arms embargo on Turkey. Now, Sweden has changed some of this. It lifted the arms embargo. It says it will crack down on some of the people Turkey thinks of as terrorists, but instead, it's since Turkey has said, no, we're still not happy, they're basically using the leverage here to get as many concessions as they can. Bear in mind there's a presidential election coming up in Turkey, so the president is clearly trying to sort of sound like a strong nationalist figure.
And Finland's entry into NATO comes just a couple of days after it held elections.
Yeah, funny, isn't it? You wait forever for one Finland story in the news and you get two at once. Indeed, yes, the Social Democrat, Sanna Marin, has lost very narrowly. A conservative national coalition party has got the most votes. Their main issue there was the economy, nothing to do with Russia. In fact, huge debts piling up in Finland, and the conservatives won with an argument that basically called for spending cuts. Now, there will be negotiations to form a coalition, but it looks like Sanna Marin has lost power.
Paul Moss. As international investigators gather evidence of atrocities in Ukraine, a war crimes trial concerning events in another part of Europe has begun in The Hague. The former president of Kosovo, Hashim Thaçi, and three co-defendants have been appearing before a special court. They stand accused of an array of crimes, including murder, torture and persecution during the independence war in the late 1990s against Serbia. Here's prosecutor Alex Whiting.
This case is also about the victims and their families. Victims of terrible crimes who have waited more than 20 years for justice. Victims who have been told again and again over those last 20 years, get over it. Move on. That is in the past. Stop talking about it. Turn the page. Justice is too hard. Justice is too expensive. All of those things are easy to say when you are not a victim.
In the years since that war of the 1990s and Kosovo's eventual independence, Mr. Thaçi has served as its prime minister, foreign minister and president. He denies all the charges against him. We heard more from our Balkans correspondent, Guy Deloney.
Opening statements from the prosecution have started. We'll also be hearing from counsel for the victims, which, as Alex Whiting was saying there, it's a very important aspect of this particular trial. They'll be explaining a little about how people were affected by these alleged crimes. We've heard very briefly from Mr. Thaçi and his three co-defendants. They've confirmed their not guilty pleas. But I think what's very important is that the prosecution has emphasised that it's not the Kosovo Liberation Army that's on trial, but these four individuals who are accused of crimes against humanity and war crimes. And they've said that they were responsible for the murders of 102 people and the forced disappearance of 20 others during that conflict in the late 1990s. And already we've been seeing the prosecution producing documents found in the defendants' homes, showing there was a chain of command in the KLA, and that the defendants, the prosecution says, could not deny knowledge or responsibility for the alleged crimes. And it's also produced evidence showing that the KLA targeted political opponents for illegal detention. So not just ethnic Serbs or Roma people, but ethnic Albanians as well, who were considered to be political opponents.
And the prosecution also making the point that the families of the victims have waited a very long time to see this day in court. Why has it taken so long to bring these charges?
It's staggering, isn't it, how slow justice can move when it comes to these sort of crimes. And this isn't even international justice. It's a court of Kosovo, which has been set up in The Hague with international officials so that you can't have the kind of witness intimidation and interference that's been a problem in previous attempts to put former leaders of the KLA on trial. So we have seen, for example, the former Prime Minister of Kosovo, Ramush Haradinaj, twice tried and twice acquitted at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. But it's been very difficult to prosecute other people, especially when they're at the head of government in Kosovo. And that's really rankled with victims who say they've never found justice for the crimes committed against them.
And briefly, if Mrs. Thaçi is found guilty, that won't be accepted in Kosovo.
It depends who you ask. I mean, some people still see him as a hero of the liberation, and they do swallow this line that it's the entirety of the KLA and the liberation struggle that was on trial. That's why you're seeing these protests against the trial.
Kai Delaney. Now, think back to a time before these sounds were a part of everyday life. Well, 50 years ago today, Marty Cooper of the Motorola Telecoms Company made the first ever public mobile phone call. But the brick-like handset he used back in 1973 was a far cry from the sleek and powerful smartphones we use now. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, has interviewed Mr. Cooper, who's now 94.
There were no cordless phones. There were no large-scale integrated circuits. The digital camera hadn't been invented. The internet didn't exist. And I was standing on 6th Avenue in New York holding this new gadget called a cell phone, and demonstrating it to a journalist like you. I wanted to show him the freedom that comes out of being able to take a phone, be able to call anybody in the world, and to be anywhere at any time. And it occurred to me that a good person to call would be my counterpart in the Bell system. The Bell system was a monopoly that if you wanted to have a telephone in the United States and many other countries in the world, you had to rent it from from this monopoly. I took out my phone book. That gives you an idea what primitive times these were. And I called my counterpart in the Bell system. And amazingly, he answered. And I said, Joel, I'm calling you a cell phone, but a real cell phone, a personal, handheld, portable cell phone. To this day, Joel does not remember that phone call, and I don't blame him, but he does dispute that I made the call.
Tell me how it worked, that first model of yours.
This phone weighs over a kilo. It has a battery life of 25 minutes. That was not a problem because you couldn't hold this up for 25 minutes. It was so heavy. All it did was make phone calls. You could make a call and receive it, but it could call anywhere in the world. And we could not make it any smaller. The battery alone was about a third of the phone. Battery technology has improved over the years. And of course, we have integrated circuits now, and every cell phone now, every mobile phone has a supercomputer in it. Now, I never could imagine that either.
Hard to believe he's 94. That was Marty Cooper, the mobile phone pioneer, speaking to Zoe Kleinman. Still to come.
And this feels like a direct attack on queer people, just in general, across the country.
A proposed law to restrict drag shows ignites controversy in Kentucky.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service that seeks out extraordinary stories from around the globe.
I'm in a trench in Ukraine with shells flying overhead, petrified.
It's a window into other people's worlds.
It can't be separated from the addictive nature of my personality.
And it's available now.
Feeling incredibly alive when death was at its closest.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. 6 years ago, a suicide bomber here in the UK killed 22 people, many of them children, at a concert in the English city of Manchester. Now, a father and daughter, Martin and Eve Hibbert, who were left with severe disabilities, have filed legal action against a conspiracy theorist who claims the attack was faked. Martin was paralysed from the waist down. Eve suffered severe brain injuries and will need care for the rest of her life. Our disinformation and social media correspondent, Mariana Spring, told us more about what's being called a landmark case.
During the original investigation, I revealed the kinds of conspiracy theories and hate that had been used to target Martin, Eve and other Manchester Arena and terror attack survivors, and also the tactics which spilled offline. And there was one conspiracy theorist in particular, a man called Richard D. Hall, who'd posted online about tracking down survivors of the Manchester Arena attack in real life to their homes and their workplaces. One of those is Eve Hibbert, and he later admitted that he had spied on Eve from a vehicle parked outside her home. as you can imagine, for Martin and Eve and the other Manchester Arena survivors, to hear that this was spilling over into real life was really scary and left them feeling very unsafe. And it's part of that that has propelled Martin today and his decision to file this claim against Richard D. Hall for harassment and for defamation, which is a landmark case here in the UK.
As you say, a landmark case here in the UK, first time it's happened here in the UK, but it has happened in the US. And a lot of people will have heard about a very similar case over the false claims made about the Sandy Hook school shooting.
Yes, this case involving Alex Jones over in America. Alex Jones is a talk show host. He's an infamous conspiracy theorist and one who has pushed these really quite shocking conspiracies about the Sandy Hook shooting that happened in 2012 in the US, suggesting that it was staged, it was faked, and it was the families of people affected by that attack who decided to take him to court, and they won. And he was ordered by a US court to pay nearly $1.5 billion in damages. We don't expect quite so much money to be involved here, but Martin, at least, and his legal team have told me that they really think this could set a precedent, and certainly that it shows us how the case that unfolded in the US has set a precedent here in the UK and perhaps could further around the world.
Because conspiracy theorists like Richard D. Hall just won't accept reality. They persist in repeating these lies and causing distress. So it's a very difficult case, isn't it? Because you have to deal with people like that, but at the same time, there are also concerns about freedom of expression.
There are, and it's interesting, since the investigation went out, at the time I confronted Richard D. Hall at the market store where he worked and where he was selling a book and DVDs promoting these theories, and he told me I was wrong about how he operated. But since then, he's posted online, continuing to suggest that the Manchester Arena attack was staged in some ways and also taking aim at other disappearances or disasters that have happened. In response to a legal letter sent by Martin's team, he again doubled down and continued to push this stuff. How it's dealt with is a question that policymakers, social media companies, people all over the world are grappling with. And there is always that question, do we risk silencing or censoring people? I certainly think for Martin, and having interviewed him on several occasions now, he strongly believes in freedom of expression. But for him, there's a line, and he feels like it's the courts that are the only place he can seek the justice that he so wants.
Mariana Spring, could an artificial nose help to fight wildfires? With the climate heating up, recent years have seen record-breaking fires in Australia, North America and Europe. One hotspot is the US state of California, and it's preparing to test a piece of technology which could reduce the billions of dollars worth of damage caused by wildfires by sniffing them out in their first few minutes. Peter Goffin reports.
More than 7,000 wildfires raged across California last year alone. Homes were burned, entire towns were evacuated, 9 people were killed. Firefighters are alerted to these blazes in a number of ways. AI-assisted cameras, drones, NASA satellites, even lookouts stationed in watchtowers. The problem is that by the time the flames and smoke can be seen by the human eye or the camera lens, the fire may already have spread out of control. The state fire service, CAL FIRE, is about to launch a pilot project that uses solar-powered sensors to detect chemical changes in the air in the earliest moments of a blaze, before a smoldering burn becomes an open flame. Karsten Brinkschulte is the head of Dryad Networks, the German startup that developed the technology. He says it could speed emergency response times by valuable minutes, or even hours.
Think of it like an electronic nose. We can detect gases like hydrogen, carbon monoxide, and volatile organic compounds. And it's using artificial intelligence built into the sensors to detect the typical smell of a fire. We then send an alarm over a wireless network that we equally also install in the forest, enabling the sensors to send their alarms and their coordinates directly to the fire brigades.
The technology has already been piloted on a small scale in more than 20 places across the US, Canada, and Europe. The CAL FIRE trial will deploy around 400 sensors and monitor a stretch of redwood forest roughly the size of 400 football fields. The United Nations has warned that as the effects of climate change worsen, wildfires will become more intense and more frequent, increasing by 14% by 2030 and 50% by the end of this century. And wildfires are drivers of climate change, too, emitting tons of carbon and destroying trees and plants which absorb CO2 from the atmosphere.
Peter Goffin, one of the most prominent Indigenous leaders of the past century in Australia, has died. Yuna Pingu, an elder of the Yolngu people, was 74. Here's Phil Mercer in Sydney.
His name meant sacred rock that stands against time, and he spent a lifetime fighting for Indigenous land rights and recognition here in Australia. He challenged powerful mining companies. He negotiated with them for the benefit of Indigenous people. Safe to say, the passing of Yuna Pingu at the age of 74 will bring about a huge amount of sadness around the country, and people are saying, many of them, that he will have a lasting legacy, and that legacy being one of hope.
Phil Mercer. Here in Britain, the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has been unveiling plans for a new police task force to crack down on gangs that sexually exploit children. And it's ignited a row over racial profiling after members of the government linked the problem to British Pakistani men. Mr. Sunak, who's of Indian heritage, claimed that political correctness had prevented action from being taken against non-white criminals. Here's our political correspondent, Ione Wells.
An independent inquiry into child sexual abuse that concluded last year found that police and councils still don't understand the risk of organised gangs grooming children in their areas and aren't collecting data which would help identify abusers. Ministers say this new task force will support police investigations and will record suspects' ethnicity to gather better data on the makeup of gangs. The Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, also outlined plans to change the law so that anyone working with children in England would be legally obliged to report suspicions of abuse. She said some authority figures had previously looked the other way because of a fear of being accused of racism.
The independent inquiry referred to there found that grooming gangs in the north of England consisted mostly of men of Pakistani heritage. However, an extensive government report in 2020 concluded that across Britain as a whole, offenders are overwhelmingly white. Saba Kaiser was the ethnic minority ambassador to that independent inquiry.
It is very, very dangerous for the government to turn child sexual abuse into a matter of colour. Child sexual abuse does not have a skin colour, it doesn't have a religion, it doesn't have a culture. Child sexual abuse does not discriminate. And so therefore, it is really, really important that we as a nation have a singular societal response to this issue, to this pandemic of child sexual abuse instances in this country. Disappointingly, I would say that the government has yet to demonstrate, show an acknowledgement of the scale of change that's needed to create and sustain a national movement against the rape and sexual abuse of children.
Saba Kaiser. Now to the US state of Kentucky, where a proposed law to restrict drag shows has ignited public debate. The governing Republicans say the rise of so-called family-friendly drag shows is wrongly exposing children to sexual content. James Menendez reports from Kentucky.
It's an unlikely setting, a community sports hall in Frankfort, the state capital of Kentucky. Frankfort's really just a small, quiet town of painted wooden houses and neat lawns. And yet here on the basketball court, under a glitter ball, a series of drag artists are strutting their stuff. But the Republicans who control the state assembly have drag performers in their sights. They're trying to push through a law that would ban drag in public places and anywhere where there are children, if there's any hint of sexual content. Tonight's show has been organised by Esper Jett, who herself performs as Jet Black.
Honestly, my biggest fear, my biggest worry is that it is a limit of self-expression. Because drag and burlesque and all of it, it's ultimately an art form that people use to be able to feel like themselves, to be able to embrace sides of themselves that they can't necessarily in their everyday life. And this feels like a direct attack on queer people, just in general, across the country.
Do you want to sit down?
Sure.
Why don't we just sit across the corner of the table? That's probably best.
So what do proponents of the measures have to say? Here's Republican State Senator Lindsay Titchener.
Drag's been around forever, but we've never seen it proposed as family-friendly. We've never seen children be invited into those types of performances. And so we started seeing more and more of this over the last year, creeping into different parts of Kentucky, all, you know, across the state in different places, Drag Queen Story Hour, family-friendly drag shows and different events. And so as we watched more of this creep into Kentucky, we started to think this is not appropriate for kids. They're not sitting there. They're dancing. They're performing. They're doing sexually explicit things. And now they're trying to reshape it to normalize it, in my opinion, to sexualize children.
And on the other side of the political aisle, Democratic State Senator Karen Berg. She knows only too well the harm that prejudice can do. Her transgender son, Henry, recently took his own life. She tells me the bill is dangerous and misunderstands what drag is about.
They are taking drag, which is basically a cultural celebration of the LGBTQ community that has nothing to do with disrobing, taking off clothing, being sexually promiscuous or overt. These are people that are celebrating beauty. And they are making it that because it makes them uncomfortable.
That was Democratic State Senator Karen Berg, ending that report by James Menendez. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting. The producer was Alison Davies. The editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.